Chapter 49. Back at the station, Molly was digging into the oldest of the composition notebooks, looking for Evan. It wasn't much of a lead. It wasn't at all clear that it was a lead at all. For a woman like Deanna Banker to refer to someone as an asshole, and for him to stick out in her memory, made him worth a little investigation. Unfortunately, the world, even in the mid-70s, was full of people like this Evan character. But Jesse and Molly agreed that from this point forward, they wouldn't be rushing around Massachusetts to do in-person interviews unless they first got more substance on the phone. Molly seemed so preoccupied by Maud Kane's notebooks that Brian Lundquist thought she might not have noticed him come through the station door. But when he tried to scoot by her, he was proven wrong.
"Where do you think you're going?" she said, never looking up. "Just because you're a big-shot statey now doesn't mean you just get to walk into Jesse's office."
"Sorry, Molly, you look busy."
"I am. Is it important?"
He waved a file at her.
"Come with me."
She knocked on Jesse's pebbled glass door and stuck her head into his office.
"What?"
"Lundquist is here."
"Get anywhere with this Evan guy?" Jesse asked.
"Not yet."
"Okay, send him in." Lundquist came in and sat across the desk from Jesse and waved the file at him, as he had at Molly.
"Full array of photos and forensics. Your man Perkins is good. Our guys said he did a first-rate job with the scene. Our guys don't drop compliments easily."
"I'll let Peter know. How about the index card?" Lundquist pulled out several enlargements of areas of the index card, came around to Jesse's side of the desk, and laid them out on the blotter. "See here, Jesse, these dark brown patches? This is old cellophane tape residue. There were still some traces of the actual tape on the card. The lab says the tape is at least 40 years old. And here, these indentations in the card that the lab highlighted, what's that look like to you?"
"A key."
"A safety deposit box key, to be precise," Lundquist said. "These numbers are the number of the box. That's the presumption. But what bank?"
Lundquist frowned.
"Good question. See this?"
He pointed to an enlargement of the top left corner of the index card found in King Kernet's rear pocket. "It's been torn here. Our best guess is that's where the name of the bank was probably written. In the meantime, we've sent all this to the FBI lab in the hope they'll be able to match the shape of the key and the number to the bank."
Now it was Jesse frowning.
"Don't hold your breath. It'll take months before they get to this. And when they do, the best they'll be able to do is come up with the manufacturer of the key and a list of the banks that might have used that type of key and lock. We're talking 40 years ago.
At least 40 years, maybe more."
Jesse asked, "Can your guys create a key from this?"
"I don't see why not."
"You mind me asking what for? We don't even know that this has anything to do with the case."
"I think we do. Look, Kernet's body didn't have ID, money, a cell phone, or car or house keys on it. Only this old index card. So he either had it on him, or the killer planted it on him."
"You're right, Jesse, but..."
Jesse stood out of his chair.
"Let's go."
"What is it?"
Jesse didn't answer directly.
"Come on," was all he said.
Chapter 50. The yellow tape was the only thing that indicated this patch of woods had been the scene of a murder. The Subaru had been towed away, and the body long since removed. The old tool shed door creaked in the wind like the surrounding trees.
"You guys have the car?" Jesse said.
Lundquist nodded.
"Nothing in it that didn't belong to the owner except Kernet's prints. Since the car was boosted from a supermarket parking lot near the New Hampshire border, we're concentrating our search for Humphrey Bolton up there. If he's been watching TV or reading the papers, he'll be gone."
"Bolton's not the swiftest guy in the world, Jesse. He's evaded capture so far."
"Good point."
Jesse looked at where the car had been yesterday.
"I didn't like it yesterday, and I like it even less today."
"What don't you like exactly?"
"I know you don't buy into the ring scenario," Lundquist said. "You think Kernet and Bolton were too thick for a jewel heist. But everything about this fits the scenario of them ripping the ring off from the Kane woman's house, and then one partner eliminating the other. The way I see it is that they knew about the ring, or, if not specifically the ring, about the Kane jewelry they thought the old woman had in the house. All they find is the ring, and that would have been okay. Would have been a nice payday, too. But then things go sideways. The woman dies, and they have to rough up the Mass X guy. Now they've got a murder rap and assault with a deadly weapon hanging over their heads, and the money for the ring won't get them what they thought it would. Now it's about survival and getting as far away as possible, maybe even getting out of the country. But the money they get from fencing the ring will get one of them a lot farther away than it will get both of them. I don't care how dumb Bolton is supposed to be, he can do simple subtraction. Jesse shook his head. I still don't like it, Brian. Why come back here when they were in spitting distance of Canada? If Bolton wanted to kill Kernut, why not do it up where they were? There are plenty of isolated areas in that part of the state to leave a body, places where no one would find it for weeks or months. Why come back to Paradise? Why call it in? Why take everything off Kernut's body and leave or plant the index card? I'm telling you, there's something else going on here that we don't see or can't see. You surprise me, Jesse. Healy always told me you were big on saying the police should follow the evidence, not their hunches. Yesterday it was a hunch, but it's more than that today. I am looking at the evidence. I'm not cherry-picking the evidence that fits a particular scenario. I'm trying to look at the evidence that hangs together and the evidence that doesn't. Okay, say I buy that and I got it wrong. That this isn't about the ring. I don't know why Kernut was killed here or who killed him, but killed here he was. Sawtooth Creek is, what, 100 yards that way? Why not put a bullet or two into Kernut's lungs and submerge him in the creek? Jesse thought about it for a second. He rubbed his right cheek with the back of the folded fingers of his right hand. All the questions have one answer, the same answer. I can't wait to hear this. Don't tell me we're looking at some twisted serial killer type or an impulse kill, because the evidence doesn't support that. Just the opposite, Brian. I think this was completely calculated. You said it yourself at Daisy's. The homemade sound suppressor is evidence of premeditation. But premeditation by who? I don't think Kernut and Bolton picked Maud Kane's house because they heard some story about jewelry when they were inside together. Someone pointed them at that house. To steal the jewelry? Jesse said, if Kernut turned up dead anywhere else, if that index card wasn't on the body, or if we didn't get that anonymous tip, I might accept it. But if it wasn't about the jewelry, then what? The Kane woman was broke. She was trying to sell her house so she could live out her last few years. What else could she have had that had any value? Good questions, Jesse said. I don't know the answers. I know someone wants media attention, and Kernut's murder here was supposed to help get it. And if he doesn't get the attention he wants, what then, Jesse? Another body? I don't think so. You better hope not, or I'll be working that case with the next Paradise chief of police. Jesse knew Lundquist was right, and there was nothing more to say for now. It was time to go. Chapter 51. Hump remembered something one of the guys inside had told him way back when he was doing juvie time. That the bigger the sandbox, the easier it was to lose yourself. Of course, that was before 9/11, before most city center blocks had cameras everywhere. And if the city didn't have a camera on every lamppost, then private businesses had them outside their buildings. Even damn taxis had dashboard cameras. Despite that, he knew he was safer far away from New Hampshire and Paradise. Safer from the cops and from the guy who had killed King. He supposed he could have easily made it to New York City, the biggest sandbox of them all. But he didn't know anybody there, didn't have anybody he could trust, or with the right kind of connections. But he knew Boston. He'd spent time here as a kid, and for a few years between bids. He felt comfortable in Boston and knew all sorts of people in town, people who might give him a room until things cooled down, or who could hook him up if and when he decided to fence the dragonfly ring. He'd been inside when that marathon bombing thing happened, but he knew the town was different now, that there were eyes all over the place that hadn't been there before. Still, if he had to keep looking over his shoulder, he felt more relaxed doing it in a place he was familiar with, a place full of people who didn't look anybody in the eye or care about anybody else's business. So far, he felt good about his choice. He hadn't gotten a second look since getting into town. He'd already found a place to hunker down for a night or two, or until he could make contact with someone who could find a better spot for him. Now he had to make a call. He hadn't wanted to make the call until he was in a safer place. That's what he told himself. The truth was, he didn't want to make the call because he didn't want to face the fact that King had fucked him. He guessed he should have figured it out because of the extra $2,000 King left behind with the note. Knowing that, he should have been happy King got what was coming to him. The thing about it was that it just made him feel more sad and stupid than betrayed. He felt pretty stupid to begin with, that he could have let King play him the way he had. The worst part of it was that King had so little respect for Hump that he hadn't even bothered covering his tracks. King had left intact the notepad where he'd scribbled down the phone number. Hump kept shaking his head whenever he thought about King's lack of respect for him. Sure, King ripped off the sheet with the phone number on it, but didn't bother with the sheets beneath it. Did he really think I was so dumb I wouldn't know how to shade in the next sheet on the notepad with the side of the pencil lead? The answer was painfully obvious. He was shaking his head as he walked into Dennis's, a dreary local bar in Southie. Hump knew the place had an old-fashioned phone booth in the back by the bathrooms. What else he knew about Dennis's was that Mickey Coyle hung out there. They weren't friends or nothing. Coyle was the kind of person who didn't need to make friends inside because he was protected by Gino Fish's money. Coyle was heavily connected, and that counted for a lot, especially in the position Hump was in. If he couldn't squeeze more money out of the guy who'd hired him and King, he was going to have to sell the ring. Mickey Coyle was the type of guy to know people who might take the ring off his hands. The back of the bar was beautifully mirrored, the way they used to do it. The bar itself was vintage, but beat up, and the stools looked pretty wobbly. There were a few guys at the bar minding their own business. Dennis's was the kind of place where people minded their own business and drank shots with tall boys back. There wasn't a blender, an olive, or an orange slice in sight. Nobody turned or looked directly at Hump. You didn't look people in the face in Dennis's. Instead, they all rolled their eyes up from their drinks or papers to see what the bar mirror told them about the big guy walking into the place. "Phone booth still in the back?" Hump asked the barman. "Ain't moved since I seen it last. Drink?" "Harpoon Tap. I'll be back in a minute." Hump found the phone booth where he remembered it. It smelled of stale beer and ancient cigarette smoke, preserved inside the sticky wall grime like insects trapped inside amber. He pulled quarters out of his pocket, sat down on the rounded ledge of a seat, and closed the booth door. He dropped the coins in the slot and punched in the number. It rang and rang and rang and rang. He put the phone back in its cradle. Hump's beer was on a coaster on the bar by a stool far away from the others. He sat down, took a sip, and waved the barman over. "What I owe you?" "$3." Hump put a 20 on the bar. When the bartender turned to walk away, Hump stopped him. "Mickey Coyle still come in here?" "Who?" The bartender was a bloated guy in his 30s with shaggy gray hair and a prison stare. "Mickey Coyle works for Gino Fish." The bartender gave Hump a strange look and laughed at him. "I say something funny?" "Not funny, just ignorant." Hump's skin burned with anger, and it took everything he had not to crack the beer glass against the side of the barman's fat face. Instead, he finished his beer in a sip and said, "You got a pencil?" The barman reached over by the register and gave him a pen. Best I can do.
Hump ripped the sheet of notepaper in half. He wrote something down and handed it and the pen to the bartender.
When Mickey comes in, give him that. Keep the change.
Hump was moving to the door.
Who?
The barman asked again without any heart, because the door was already closing.